brothers and sisters in Christ. This Congress faces an awesome task. It must fashion a new vessel in which to carry the old wine of American Anglicanism. This is a heavy responsibility. It is also very hard work. Unlike our Roman Catholic co-religionists, we do not have an authoritative power structure to point the way, to set limits to divergence, to bound in orthodoxy. Unlike virtually all of our Protestant fellows, we are not free agents under God, able to create a new, largely untrammeled by tradition, free of history. We are children of history. Our Anglican tradition is the child of history. It is a long history, 2 millennia in the apostolic faith, and almost half a millennium as a peculiar institution, which is Anglicanism. The reverend and learned gentlemen who have preceded me this evening have treated the nature of authority within this tradition. I am neither able nor so bold as to attempt a gloss upon their addresses. What I seek to do is to remind you of some of the salient points of Anglicanism's history, that history might be a light under your feet as you begin a new epoch in the history of Anglicanism and as you seek your way along a new path. I hope devoutly that though the epoch and the path may be new, the faith will be old. In the choice of bottle and of wine lies the hardness of the rock upon which this convention will either build a tabernacle under the Lord or will founder in failure and oblivion. Since the Reformation, Anglican apologists have felt compelled to argue strenuously that Henry VIII did not create a new church. At their best, Anglican apologists produce some very sound scholarship on the apostolic succession and on the nature of the pre-Augustinian church in Britain. At their worst, they produce such arrant nonsense as the notion that the Ecclesia Anglicana was never entirely subjected to Roman authority and continued through the Middle Ages to flourish once again with the Henrician Reformation. The apologists were right, of course, that Henry VIII did not create a new church, although he came perilously close to it. And under his successors, Edward VI and Elizabeth I, only the accident of the validity of Anglican orders kept the Church of England firmly in the continuity of the Apostolic Church. However, what I want to stress are the elements of novelty in the Reformation of the Catholic faith in England. Those things which Henry VIII and his successors did, in fact, create de novo. The distinctive qualities that we associate with the Anglican branch of the Holy Catholic Church have their origin in the novel features of the English Reformation of the 16th century and its ultimate settlement in the 17th century. The Henrician Reformation between 1529 and 1547 was essentially an act of state, an act of the assertive Tudor monarchy, which was the English manifestation of a very general European phenomenon. We are still not sure, we probably never will be, when Henry VIII decided upon a formal constitutional split with the papacy. But we do know that in 1534, the Ecclesia Anglicana was by act of parliament separated from Rome, and all power and authority of any foreign prince or potentate explicitly excluded in the same power and authority confirmed in the King of England and his successors as supreme head of the Church of England. While the king was supreme head on earth of the church, he had no spiritual jurisdiction, was not in orders, not a bishop. And the clear intent behind the legislation was not to take away any power from the successors of the apostles, that is, the bishops, that had been given them by God. Clearly, the Church of England was to remain an apostolic church. Equally clearly, it was to become the spiritual guardian of the English people under the English monarch in his capacity as supreme head. This was a very peculiar arrangement for the 16th century. At the time, only the Eastern Orthodox Church of defunct Byzantium and isolated Russia vested such guardianship over souls in a secular ruler. The Protestant princes of Germany and the backwash of the Lutheran Reformation were only tentatively launched on this road, while those monarchs who remained faithful to the See of Rome managed to grasp a greater control over the church within their kingdoms, but of course did not aspire to such a supreme headship, which perforce remained in the Pope. There were two results of this peculiar arrangement. The Church of England was subject to secular political control, and it was the church of the English nation and of the English people. Unlike either Lutheranism or Calvinism in the Protestant states, or Roman Catholicism in those states remaining loyal to Rome, Anglicanism was not an international church. It would expand outside the realm of England only as the English nation expanded. First to Ireland, then the Americas, and ultimately, of course, to the furthest reaches of the British Empire of the 18th to the 20th centuries. In short, from the outset, the Church of England was responsive to secular concerns, and it was an established national church, encompassing all Christian souls within the boundaries of the nation. The line between church and state could not be finely drawn, neither could the line between the Englishman as a subject of the king and as an Anglican. The 17th century was a century of struggle for definition of these two entities. The final incomplete and uneasy settlement left the church established, but recognized that not every Christian Englishman was an Anglican. Interestingly, this solution, such as it was essayed first in England's American colonies along the Atlantic seaboard, which exhibited no uniformity in the matter of establishment and considerable diversity in religious observance, ecclesiastical structure, and theological interpretations. For Anglicanism in America, the United States Constitution of 1789, by decreeing the separation of church and state, removed the last, literally hopeless chance for establishment, and this, the establishment's survival. The pluralism of American religion was already so highly developed that Anglicanism had long ceased to have any holy national identification in the North American colonies. But the legacy of establishment and nationalism remained. In its crudest form, the establishment quality of American Episcopalianism is caught in the old saw about the derelict who is plucked from the gutter by the Salvation Army, dried out by the Baptists, taught how to sing by the Methodists, introduced to the Bible by the Presbyterians, and made socially acceptable by the Episcopalians. The elite of merit in America has broadened well beyond the vestries of the Episcopalian parish church, but the Episcopal Church retains an identification with culture, intellectualism, and tolerant rationalism, a certain worldliness and cosmopolitanism, an appreciation of pluralism and diversity of outlook, which are associated with assured position, the opportunity for leisure, and education. This is always a bit surprising to me. We've never put great stress on a highly intellectualized clergy. We have no high-powered intellectual orders of clergy such as the Roman Church boasts. We've been far less distinguished by theologians of real creativity than most of the Protestant churches. We have seldom managed to reach a very original level in ecclesiastical architecture and furnishings, ecclesiastical sculpture and painting, though we rarely descend to egregious bad taste. Perhaps the most marked feature of our branch of the Catholic faith is our tolerant rationalism. Certainly, this is in greatest part derived from the nationalistic quality of early Anglicanism in England. Only the Church of England could claim to be the church of all Englishmen. Long after dissent had cost the church a large minority of its adherents, even after a resurgent Roman Catholicism could count almost as many communicants in England as the Church of England had, the church by law established remained the touchstone of the nation's religious life. The great battle of the 17th century, between the Puritans on the one hand and the ecclesiastical and political establishment on the other, was a struggle to be the Church of England. The defeat of the Puritan Party in the aftermath of the Civil War as an interregnum of Oliver Cromwell in the mid-17th century reaffirmed government by episcopacy. But it also forced episcopacy to recognize that the established church could not reduce the large body of dissenters to a sullen obedience. The dissenting religious bodies would have to be accorded a measure of freedom, of observance, and that Anglicanism could survive as the national church only by tolerating great divergency of practice and opinion within itself. Indeed, this was a return to the Elizabethan church of the late 16th century, which, while it was avowedly Protestant and a very advanced, even Calvinistically inclined Protestantism at that, stressed fundamentally the allegiance of Englishmen to the church and state rather than to a highly defined, peculiar theological or cradle position. The myth that the Church of England has always been a via media between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism is a long time a dying. But a myth it is. The Church of England really never has been such a via media. It is best seen as a unique blend of Christian ways and ideas, The Catholic dimension was preserved by the continuity of the apostolic succession in episcopal governance under the state. The Protestant evangelical dimension had a grassroots origin at the parochial level among lower clergy and laity. It was only with the truce between contending factions over the course of comprehensiveness in religion in the late 17th century that Anglicanism, that the established church, found that it must live with diversity, with high and low and middle, if it was to survive as a national church. The emphasis on a few fundamental doctrines, rigorous commitment to a single order of worship in the Book of Common Prayer, allegiance to government by bishops in the apostolic succession, was as much as the Church of England could demand by 1660. All else was adiaphora, matters indifferent, matters to be tolerated within the Church as diversities and practices and beliefs. The secular and nationalist Church of England of the Reformation made a fundamental break with the long tradition of sacerdotalism of the medieval Catholic Church. The dissolution and spoiling of the monasteries that left the countryside of England pockmarked with bare ruined choirs went a long way toward reducing the clerical population, both in numbers and in importance. This reinforced the power of lay patronage in the appointment of parish clergymen and increased the number of livings in the hands of lay patrons. More basically, the national church was henceforth under the supreme headship of a layman, or even lay woman, in the person of the monarch. England became increasingly hostile to clerical autocracy in church government. This tradition was, of course, formalized in the structures of the advanced Protestant groups which became the dissenting bodies of the Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Baptists, and others. While never so completely instituted in the Church of England, it was a strong element in the life of the church, epitomized in the 18th and 19th centuries alliance of manor house and vicarage, squire and parson. American Episcopalianism went even a step further, in great part because until the beginning of our national existence, we had no resident episcopacy in this country. In the General Convention of the Episcopal Church, with its two houses, in the enormous power of the parochial vestry, was created the constitutional involvement of the lay element in government of the Episcopal Church in America, as we have known it. But the origins of lay involvement are as old as the Henrician Reformation, and that lay reformer, the supreme head himself, Henry VIII. The Anglican emphasis on lay involvement within a Catholic tradition is worth stressing at this moment. The authors of our present woes and divisions in the Episcopal Church are primarily clergymen, not laymen, and laywomen. I have not detected any great groundswell of demand for the ordination of women and so-called prayer book reform among the laity. We are the victims of that recurring phenomenon. We are the victims of that recurring phenomenon in ecclesiastical change and turmoil, the treasonous clerks. Clerics, for a multitude of reasons, commendable and despicable, find themselves dissatisfied with the institution which they can conceive of only as their institution. The church does not belong to the clergy. It is Christ's, entrusted to the entire body of Christians, quick and dead, without respect to orders. If this Congress fails to reaffirm the true lay responsibility in the life of the church, it might just as well deliver us back again to the bondage of the Episcopal Church's clerical autocrats. If we are to remain true to our history as Anglicans, we must also seek as great a comprehensiveness as we can, commensurate with our commitment to the apostolic faith centered in the apostolic succession. In short, as children of the English Reformation of the 16th and 17th centuries, we must try to unite Christians in Christ's fellowship with as few doctrinal tests as possible. Yet, like our forefathers of the late 17th century, we must maintain government by bishops standing in the apostolic succession. This is not a matter indifferent. The Anglican Church of the 17th century produced martyrs to this commitment, including an Archbishop of Canterbury and the Supreme Governor of the Church of England himself, Charles I. I believe, though I do not have time left to argue it, that the ordination of women, certainly the consecration of a woman bishop, would be an explicit denial of the apostolic succession's validity and value. And again, as with our forefathers who in the time of proscription under the rule of the saints, those vehement primitivists, typified by Oliver Cromwell himself, as our forefathers then held to the Book of Common Prayer, even at the cost of imprisonment and deprivation, we must hold to that most magnificent order of worship. This is also not a matter indifferent. One church, one liturgy, expressing one faith. Whether high and crazy, low and lazy, medium and hazy, Anglicans have been knit into the one fellowship in Christ's body by a single liturgy. Nothing else really gives us much unity save that liturgy. In the Reformation era, the Anglican tradition began with that liturgy, that single and singular liturgy. It was forged in that liturgy. It was maintained by that liturgy. We are nothing without that liturgy. And 1,001 pages, with choice according to mood, and do-it-yourself schematics, is not a Book of Common Prayer. Inviting the dissolution of the last elements of unity that our marvelously diverse tradition provide. It is that liturgy of our tradition set forth in the Book of Common Prayer that makes comprehensiveness possible. Those who have given us the 1,001 pages evidence that same urge to primitivism which characterized the sectarians of Cromwell's day. Those sectarians destroyed the Anglican Church for a season, mindless of the tradition that had given them life. Our contemporary sectarians have effectively destroyed that church in this past 12 months. We are called here to reestablish it on its historic foundations and mindful of its history. Let me, in closing, evoke again the person and the symbol of Charles I. As a professional historian of the Tudor-Stuart period, whose scholarly work has been focused for a quarter of a century on the unhappy reign of that king and supreme governor of the Church of England, I am very much aware of Charles I's failings and of his weaknesses. He is no saint in my book, but a martyr he was. Perhaps the noblest act of a regal career marred by deviousness, myopia, and considerable casual callousness was Charles Stuart's unwavering commitment to the validity of Anglicanism in a world in which the prime antagonists, Rome and Geneva, their satraps and adherents, reviled Anglicanism as spurious and heterodox. He gave his life on the block for that commitment on the 30th of January, 1649. To Charles I, Anglicanism was not a via media between extremes partaking of features of both, but it was a corpus of Christians living the traditional apostolic faith shorn of the excesses of medieval and Tridentine Catholicism on the one hand, and sufficiently reformed to have no need of John Calvin's caustic broom of reformed Protestantism on the other. Is this view of the Anglican Church really any less true today? Do we Episcopalian Anglicans, in our concern to retain the apostolic Catholic faith of the ages, as well as a biblically founded witness of evangelical concerns, have to flee the havens of our Roman friends or Orthodox brethren, or the more fundamentalist Protestant churches? Emphatically no, because no other church or sect adequately comprehends our mix of balance of traditions, concerns, and emphases. This is no time to lose faith with our tradition. This is the moment to reaffirm it on its historic foundations. If we allow our expression and manifestation of the Catholic faith to disappear, we have merely surrendered to our detractors of centuries. We, who have held that our messy openness is derisive, while they gradually and perceptibly have come to copy our tolerance in practice. Anglicanism still has something unique, different, and precious to offer divided Christendom in a secular world. If we fail, if we disappear, Christendom will be the loser. Our fellow Christians of different churches, that much more diminished. If we remain within the present Episcopal Church, Anglicanism in this country will have been reduced merely to another mainline Protestant church. We here, tonight, these days, carry the burden of traditional Anglicanism. We must not fail. By the grace of God and with the help of God, we will not fail.